UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, reports that more than 60 babies are born each day in the crowded camps in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, where thousands of Rohingya refugees are now sheltering. That's 16,000 births since August, when the Rohingya began fleeing Myanmar en masse. I'm Deanne Penn. Welcome to UN Gender Focus, a podcast from the United Nations in New York. The Rohingya are a Muslim community that has lived for centuries in Myanmar, which is predominantly Buddhist. It's suspected that an untold number of Rohingya women were raped by Myanmar armed forces and local militias during what Andrew Gilmore, the UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights, has described as a frenzy of sexual violence allegedly perpetrated as part of a strategy to push Rohingya out of their homes. Here's Mr. Gilmore, who was in Cox's Bazar in March.
These horrific events took place 8 months ago, 8.5 months ago. Now, of course, if rape is carried out on what we believe could have been a massive scale, there is inevitably going to be a surge of births. And again, we don't know how many women and girls are pregnant now. We have heard reports of a lot of self-induced abortion, including of girls as young as 14 years old. I've spoken to aid workers, and I've spoken to victims or people who have recently arrived and reported that there are still ongoing rapes.
UN experts believe that what happened to these Rohingya women is the same as what countless other women have experienced in conflicts in places such as Bosnia, Iraq, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where rape was considered among the spoils of war.
It's the most underreported human rights violation because the cost of reporting such a crime by a survivor often outweighs the benefits because of the deep stigma that surrounds this issue and the fact that, you know, survivors, can sometimes survive a rape but then succumb to the stigma that follows it.
That's Tondarai Chukwua, Chief of Staff and Senior Policy Advisor in the Office of the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Sexual Violence in Conflict. He is among the UN experts who fear Rohingya refugee women, marginalized because of rape, as well as their children, could fall victim to traffickers or be lured to join extremist groups. Mr. Chukwua headed a team deployed to Bangladesh last November by Pramila Patton, the UN's expert on stamping out wartime rape. Ms. Patton, who's referred to as an SRSG in UN terminology, returned there in early May. I spoke to Mr. Chukwua just prior to her return to UN headquarters.
The visit in Bangladesh is a natural part of the follow-up. During our time on the ground, a lot of valuable, very painful, difficult information came up about the nature, patterns, trends of sexual violence being committed against the Rohingya in Myanmar. And it was really, it was one of the deepest traumas that I've experienced in years of working on these issues. The testimonies of survivors and witnesses are quite horrific, very graphic, and very consistent, which is always a sign from an investigation perspective of the veracity of those accounts. And they detail a level of just horrific sexual violence being perpetrated primarily by Myanmar security forces, particularly by the National Army of Myanmar, the Tatmadaw, whom on that basis, the Secretary General has listed for the first time in his recently released annual report on conflict-related sexual violence. But other parties implicated are Myanmar Border Guard Police, as well as militias, Rakhine Buddhist militias, if one can put it in that way. And really what survivors detail are not only rape, but gang rape. Testimony of women and men being separated. men often being killed, women being taken to be raped. Very painful testimony of young girls being tied to a rock or a tree and being literally raped to death. And what made the visit to Cox's Bazar so difficult and painful, and I would say unusual, is that these violations were ongoing while we were on the ground. There were new refugees that were coming in even as the SRSG was having consultations in the camps. So it's a situation where the trauma is so visceral and so raw, which is different from some of the other settings that we work in, where there may have been refugee camps or IDP camps established for many years, and where there, of course, is hardship and trauma. But it wasn't, it's unusual to find it so raw, so visceral, so immediate. It was traumatic for all of us as a team.
You mentioned that this trip was in November. How long were you there?
The special representative sent an advance team, which I led. Advance team was on the ground for 10 days or so, and it was a team composed of members of the UN Action Network, which is a network of 13 UN entities working on conflict-related sexual violence, chaired by the SRSG. And the SRSG then came in following that advanced technical mission and spent an additional 10 days on the ground.
It's a lot of time.
It's part of the methodology of our mandate. We do know that when UN principles at that level travel, it's usually hard for a number of reasons to have them on the ground for a long time. But we really feel that one of the things that distinguishes our mandate is that we try to put our principle on the ground for enough time really to be able to see the layers of this problem. Our former special representative, Zainab Bangura, used to describe this problem as an onion, and the more you peel, the more layers there are, and the more tears you have in your eyes. And that's a good analogy, and our new special representative, Pramila Patton, is very committed to a deep field-based engagement and engaging with survivors. Her commitment is that in everything that this mandate does, it has to be a practical survivor-centered approach, and that means engaging with the communities. And then I would say also that even though the focus, of course, is on the violations that have occurred in Myanmar, the reality is also that in Bangladesh, there are now new protection considerations that the government of Bangladesh is struggling to deal with and needs support for. Real concerns around trafficking in the camps, trafficking of women and children. This has been a long-standing issue that the Bangladeshi authority security services have been dealing with in Bangladesh, because it's been an epicenter of drugs trafficking and drug networks of organized crime. And of course, with this tremendous influx, 800,000 people in a matter of months, it's exacerbated challenges that they are already facing.
Is there any way of knowing how many women were affected? I guess it's impossible, right?
You know, the challenge with this crime is that information is always very difficult from several standpoints. It's the most underreported human rights violation, because the cost of reporting such a crime by a survivor often outweighs the benefits because of the deep stigma that surrounds this issue. And the fact that, you know, survivors, if I can say, can sometimes survive a rape, but then succumb to the stigma that follows it in terms of, you know, whether it be social isolation, being ostracized within their community, not to mention the physical or health implications of enduring such attacks. So the issue of the stigma that follows sexual violence is one of the major factors impacting the level of information that we have. That, of course, is critical for any kind of response at any level. But I think one has to also put pieces together, put two and two together. We know the numbers of people that have fled. It's almost 800,000 in a very short period of time. And in the discussions, the UNFPA organized focus group discussions that the SRSG had, and in the reporting of the gender-based violence area of responsibility, survivors are saying essentially that between 50 and 60% of women experienced some sort of sexual violence or witnessed sexual violence. So the numbers are incredibly high. And even other telltale statistics the SRSG heard in November, that in the camps there were over 70,000 pregnancies. It's not clear that all of those are from sexual violence, but it's also very likely that that many of them are. And this is a huge protection concern in and of itself. Real challenges around, you know, a generation of children, thousands of children are growing up stateless, with no hope of resolution of that either on the Myanmar or the Bangladesh side, in the context where there is a global market competing for young, disenfranchised people for all sorts of purposes, including recruitment into criminal networks and gangs or recruitment into extremist groups. And that is a real and serious dynamic here, because it is also very reasonable, fair to say that the violence happening on the Myanmar side are along ethnic and religious fault lines. You know, it's not a small consideration that ISIL at the time declared a jihad in support of the Rohingya, because it was seen as an attack against Muslim communities. So, you know, it's a dangerous mix of circumstances, both immediate protection concerns, but medium to long-term considerations for international peace and security. And that's one of the reasons why the Security Council is so seized of and focused on this problem.
And they were there too.
And they were there as well. Yeah. I mean, we always try to be strategic and felt that it was, you know, the council carried a lot of concerns related to conflict-related sexual violence. And we felt that it would be a good timing for the SRSG to go back now, not only because of the coming monsoon, but to ensure that we carry some of the momentum from the council's focus and the council's visit immediately after.
I just wanted to ask you, because you mentioned a good point about the stigma of the victims, but if children are born from this situation, I'm sure that those children are stigmatized too. And as you said, in general, children who are disenfranchised could be easily targeted. But is there a specific concerns about children born of rape or from sexual violence?
Yes, absolutely. It's, I would say, one of the new issue areas that the Secretary General has been focusing on in his annual report over the last couple of years. It's one of the, what I would say, gaps that exist, including in the normative framework of resolutions that the Council has put in place dealing with conflict-related sexual violence. There hasn't been any reference in those resolutions to children born of rape. And yet, as you rightly kind of hint, the stigma of sexual violence crimes is intergenerational. It passes from the survivor, the mother, to children. And the special representative actually saw that in a very painful way, a very visceral way, in one of her very first visits. SRSG Patton went to Bosnia, where she met with survivors of sexual violence during the war. That's 20 years past, but she met with the children of those survivors as well, who are now, you know, in their 20s. And she came back deeply touched and concerned about how stigma of sexual violence against their mothers has manifested in their own lives and how they live on the margins of society. Even the issue of, you know, identity, that's an issue there in the context of the Middle East and Iraq, which we're focusing on, and the Yazidis, for instance. A woman is unable to confer identity on her children in the absence of being married or without being able to prove paternity. And in the case where there have been so many births as a result of rape by ISIL, for instance, the issue of the identity of children, which is the basis for access to any services, education, etc., those are real and pressing issues. And that's an issue and a concern that we're not seeing in only one or two places. It's not just the Rohingya in the camps in Bangladesh. This is the Yazidis and other minorities that were targeted in the context of Iraq and Syria. You know, this is women and girls abducted by Boko Haram in Nigeria. This is Somali women and girls abducted by Al-Shabaab. Because these groups are using sexual violence not in a coincidental or incidental way. We've been discussing this with the Security Council, that violence against women and sexual violence is part of the core strategy of some of these extremists, including an incentive for recruitment, the promise of sexual access for young men and boys is a big driver of recruitment, and even the issue of funding of terrorism, fundraising through the sale, trade, trafficking of women and girls is a huge issue, and the reason why we're very concerned about trafficking dimensions in the context of the Rohingya crisis as well.
And in terms of the refugees have come to Bangladesh, has Myanmar been engaged on this? Has there been any response from them? Because it's their army that has allegedly been raping these women.
Well, yes, no, you're right to refocus the question to the heart of it. The information that we have is that Myanmar security forces are, you know, the ones credibly suspected of condoning these crimes. Our strategy and the emphasis of the Secretary General has been on constructive engagement with the member states. The solution to these issues lies with them. And so it cannot be a strategy of just naming and condemning. There has to be a process, an attempt for constructive engagement. The special representative requested several times to visit, and initially that was not approved, but we're very pleased that before the end of last year, the government of Myanmar invited the special representative. It wasn't possible to go to Rakhine, but they took this visit very seriously. The special representative met with the state councillor and several key ministries, the Ministry of Defense. We had almost 4-hour working session with the military commission established to investigate the crimes in Rakhine. They took us through methodology, etc. Obviously, in an attempt to exonerate themselves, but it was an important engagement. And before this follow-up visit to Bangladesh, the special representative again wrote to the Myanmar authorities to request a visit. We haven't received a response on that. In our discussion with them, we have put on the table formally a draft of a joint communique between the United Nations, between our mandate and the government, the heart of which is to address impunity for alleged crimes and to work with their security forces and their justice sector. We are still waiting for a formal response. We've been told that it is under consideration. But obviously the velocity of that discussion needs to be much greater because of the scope scale of the problems that we're dealing with. So, but we we're still in discussions, and they have not been completely closed to addressing these issues.
Thank you. Mr. Chikuwa, you pointed out lots of different conflicts where sexual violence has been used, like Boko Haram in Nigeria, in Somalia, of course the Rohingya situation in Myanmar, ISIL in Iraq and Syria, Bosnia 20 years ago. But I mean, stretching back, I guess, since war ever was born, there's been sexual violence.
That's right.
What's changed in recent years? Is it that we've seen an intensification of sexual violence, or is it just that because of the nature of the world now, we know more about it?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is a crime that is as old as history. And I think that what has distinguished it is that it's always been shrouded in a deep silence for many different reasons. We don't talk about sex and sexuality, and yet this is not about that. This is about power and violence and strategy. But there are many reasons why there's been a silence through the ages. And what's different now is that the silence is broken. There is sustained focus and attention on this, and I think that we can't underestimate the paradigm shift that has occurred in the past 10 years since the establishment of this mandate. A recognition by the international community and the Security Council in particular that conflict-related sexual violence is a legitimate threat to international peace and security, and as such requires an operational security response, an operational justice response. And of course, we need to take care of the sacred duty of care for survivors who have already passed through these crimes. I think the political momentum is unlike we've ever seen before. Member states have prioritized this issue as a standing issue on the Council's agenda. That's not been an easy process, because the space or the constellation of our problems, of our human rights concerns, is a large constellation. But there's been focused attention on this issue, and I think that also breaks one of the misconceptions that has paralyzed action through the ages, the misconception that somehow sexual violence crimes are a lesser evil in a false hierarchy of human rights violations. And actually, even when we engage with some of the perpetrators, sometimes when it dawns on them that these people are here to speak about sexual violence, the reaction is sometimes, well, you know, we could have killed those women, so what's the big deal? This is only rape. But when we understand the fact that these are violations not only against the individual, but they target communities, that these kind of crimes that break all moral and social and cultural taboos, they make it difficult to reestablish peace, to reconcile communities, you know, and that's why the sexual violence has been used. It's so effective in terms of really fracturing the social structures, you know, and tearing the social fiber.
But have we ever seen a situation where the survivors have got justice or had justice served? I mean, are there examples? Is it possible? Is it
yes. It is not easy, of course. But I think that one of the things that's been encouraging for me in the years now that I've been working on this is that the answer to the question, is it possible to eradicate these crimes, to prevent these crimes? The answer is yes. We always like to say that if we accept that sexual violence is not incidental, coincidental, that it is commanded, then it can be controlled. And we have seen justice. There have been dramatic cases at the international level. The Jean-Pierre Bemba case of, you know, this DRC commander convicted of command responsibility for sexual violence in terms of violations that happened in the Central African Republic. That's an important case. there have been prosecutions over the years at the international level. The International Court for Rwanda, for Yugoslavia, prosecuted sexual violence cases. The Special Court for Sierra Leone prosecuted sexual violence cases. But perhaps more importantly, we are beginning to see justice at the national level, because those are important symbols of international justice, but that's far removed from the scene of the crime, literally. And these processes are expensive, they take a long time, and the survivors need to have a sense of justice. The concept of justice needs to be locally grounded, closer to where the violations occurred. And it's actually one of the reasons why our new special representative, Pramila Patten, is focusing not only on criminal justice and accountability for the perpetrators, but on restorative justice and transitional justice for the survivors, reparations for survivors, what they need, their livelihood and economic support that they need to be able to pick up the pieces of their lives and support their families, you know. So the restorative justice as a complement and in tandem to criminal justice is a very important aspect of her strategy and her approach.
Tondarai Chikua from the UN office leading the fight to eliminate conflict-related sexual violence, rounding out this latest edition of the UN Gender Focus podcast. I'm Deanne Penn at UN headquarters in New York. Thanks for listening in, and hope you'll join us again soon.